podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the Friday Show. It's Neil Atkinson with Ian Ryan and Jim Johnson for now. We will be joined by Luke Davis soon to talk about the Blues, but we will also be joined by David Mooney and Andy Middleton to talk about Manchester City and West Ham United. So that is Arsenal, Manchester City, Everton, West Ham and Liverpool chat to come. We will start though with Arsenal. It is the Community Shield, and we've got Jim in, which is good to have. On the top of a new season. And Jim, my first sort of note on this is I feel as though of all the sides over the summer, the ones who have felt as though are acting with the greatest sense of purpose and certainty. I've got Arsenal 1, Newcastle 2, and everyone else a bit of a wreck for numbers, 3 down to 7 or 8. And, you know, it looks like Arsenal have built on what they've recruited last January in Trossard and Jorginho. It feels as though it's all very rational and very calm.
Well, Neil, I don't actually know how we managed to do the deals that we did. I mean, when we were talking earlier in the close season and we were doing the shows around if it was my team, what would we do? I even said I didn't think Arsenal would get Declan Rice. And so the fact that we did suggests that there was a long-term plan to get the player, that his people were talking to our people for a long, long time. And I think when deals are done of that magnitude and with that money involved, fair play to West Ham. They stood their ground and, you know, put in place the demands that they wanted. But Arsenal kept on coming back to the table, chipping away. And whether or not the other players that they were linked with, players like Casido, were just smoke screens, that ultimately they were always after that one guy, I mean, I'm highly delighted. I mean, it's the best bit of business Arsenal have done in probably 20 years. I mean, we look serious. We look like grown-ups again at the table. You know, none of this Jovinio, Chamakh nonsense that we used to just scratch around trying to do. We wanted that player. He was the desired player. He was the most, certainly one of the top three targets in midfield, in Europe, world football. And we got him. We add to that a bit of a surprise in Havertz. But I think if you look behind it, we knew that Xhaka was going. The manager obviously has a plan for Havertz, that he's going to be a left eight probably, but he's got a bit of versatility. I know there have been some question marks around Havertz. I'm not a naysayer. I trust the process. I trust the manager. He's not a shit player by any stretch of the imagination. He's maybe stuttered a little bit at Chelsea, but do you know what? Most players have stuttered a bit at Chelsea recently, and I think 60 million's probably about market value for a player with his experience. You know, he's come with good pedigree from the Bundesliga. He's won trophies at Chelsea. I bet you he couldn't wait to get out of that basket case. So I'm all for that. In addition, Timber. Well, I tell you what I think about Timber. I think Timber's going to be a bit of a utility man for Arteta. I'm not entirely sure where that guy is going to play. Obviously, he played at the back for Ajax, but I think moving forward, he might do that little bit of the inverted fullback. I think he might play as a holding midfielder a little bit. We obviously clearly needed cover on the right side of defence, so he fits that bill. But he's the exciting one for me because he's a bit of the unknown quantity. There is one other thing I'd say before we open it out. The Jesus injury just feels like a right pain in the arse right now, because you have him fit and you know, he was a long time coming back. And I don't think he, at the end of last season, I don't think he ever really came back to what he was before the World Cup and before the injury. So we're still waiting to see what will you know, transpire with him. But I think we got the numbers. It's just hard when you lose your number one striker.
It looks to me from the outside, you know, what's happening in that midfield, Odegaard, Rice, Partey, Jorginho, Havertz, as though he's going to very much have the sense that he's picking three from that every week. That'll be the shake-up. Feels as though that's sufficiently strong, whether or not it's sufficiently deep. He's then got Vieira, Elneny, maybe Smith-Rowe, depending on where Smith-Rowe will operate, because he might do some stuff wide areas as well. And also, a year out's a long time for a player of that age to get himself back. But there is the feeling there, I think, you know, there might be some games where it's Partey and Rice, there might be some games where it's Jorginho and Rice, with Odegaard. There might be some games because there's Champions League football this year, which there wasn't last, where Havertz plays, Odegaard takes a rest in those ones. And that's how it operates. It seems like, to me, I think he's got a nice balance is what I'm saying. I think he's got a nice balance of options from the outside looking in.
I think one of the interesting things was if you take the Monaco friendly last night as a bit of a test case. Rice played about an hour, but he played much further forward than he does for West Ham or for England. So I think that's quite interesting. But I think with Rice playing a bit further forward, it does enable us to maybe, as you rightly say, rotate the likes of Odegaard a little bit. Odegaard looked like he was pulling tugs at the end of last season.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know,
really long campaign for him in the
really,
end.
Yeah. And he's only a young guy. And he carried the weight as the captain. He carried a lot on his shoulders. And, you know, he did it at a point when, to be fair, Partey, who's supposed to be our number one guy at the time, really, really dropped off a cliff with his form. And in the end, by the end of the season, Partey was playing as a makeshift right back. And, you know, Xhaka was the go-to guy. I'm very interested to see what happens with the removal of Xhaka, because I think there's been a kind of a loyalty thing there. He's obviously wanted to move back to his closer to his homeland. I think there was talk of him meeting the Xabi Alonso thing. I think there's a whole thing about him, you know, wanting to be, you know, to think about the next phase of his career, which is obviously probably in coaching. And everybody who's had Xhaka has rated him, and the manager will have been wanting to do the decent thing with him. But Partey and Xhaka took us to a level, right? We need to now be going to the next level. And we all know what that next level is, right? But in order to do that, you've got to have serious signings. And I think we've got them.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I think getting those moves done early on, I think if you're an Arsenal fan, must have given you loads of kind of comfort, because I think on the back of a really good season, albeit one that ends in a bit of heartache because you've come so close, to then be so front foot, Jim, and go and get those signings over the line, I thought was pretty impressive. Don't know loads about Timber other than the kind of versatility piece that he offers, which I think is really, really useful from an Arsenal point of view. I think the Rice is the one that just grabs your attention, because yes, it's a big fee, and I've heard, you know, certainly fans of our club on some of these shows and certainly on the internet talk about it's maybe more money than you should pay for someone like Rice. But I think if you're an Arsenal fan, you're not really bothered, because you just want the quality through the door. And that's what he is. He's absolute quality with a level, or with more potential to jump up another level, yeah. I think, which is really... I mean, they've got three players there and they're all 24 or under.
Yeah.
I think Havertz just turned 24, Rice is 24, Timber's 22. So again, it's Arteta putting his faith in young players. I do wonder whether there's maybe... Or there would have been one or two through the door that maybe have got a little bit more experience, because it is a young side, isn't it? Lots of young players. And if you take one or two punches on the nose, you sometimes think, do you need a little bit of experience in and around the camp just to maybe get you through some tough times? The other things that I'm interested in, really, do you think there was any sense of maybe keeping Balogun around? Because it looks like he's going to go through the exit door, because there's some clubs sniffing around. I know, I think it was Inter Milan was sniffing, I think West Ham was sniffing. Arsenal are looking for big money for him, aren't they? But with the Jesus injury, was there any sign of maybe keeping him in and around the place just to get you through a period of time, or is that not a non-starter?
Well, it's interesting you say that, Ian, but I do think now that Jesus is going to be sidelined, no, they haven't said how long either. They've just said
weeks.
Yeah,
they've
just said weeks, because it's a flare up from the previous condition. So, and Nketiah started last night and scored. I believe he captained the team as well, which is kind of interesting. If you were asking me, who would you keep as the sort of second striker, I'd be tending to lean towards Balogun, because Balogun comes with this kind of pedigree and you know, story from his time in, you know, playing in France last season.
At Middlesbrough before that, wasn't he as well?
Well, yeah, and he did okay. But the thing I would say is, in spite of his goals in France last season, he was behind Mbappe, and the guy that finished top of the goal scoring charts in France last year was Lacazette. And Lacazette wasn't pulling up any trees for Arsenal. So I think possibly you know, yes, you're absolutely right, if they can get the money for him. But just on the subject of the money, you mentioned about Declan Rice. I think all that Arsenal have done there is done something that they've never, ever done in the last 20 years since the Emirates, and that's paid market value for a player. Right, they've always tried to do one on the cheap or look around the corner, see if we can get like maybe not the right, maybe a version of that player. Since we won the title, and don't get me wrong, you never replace certain types of players. At any one time, we have always had a player who was one of the top players in his position in the world. Cesc Fabregas, Robin van Persie, right? The one player we've never, ever replaced is Patrick Vieira, right? Never replaced. Because you don't replace players like Patrick Vieira. And the interesting thing about Declan Rice is he doesn't remind me of Patrick Vieira as a player, but he does remind me of Roy Keane. And the thing about Rice is kind of up and down. You talk about the experience. This is West Ham's captain. And this is a West Ham captain who's just won their first trophy in 40 years. So I think he comes with a huge level of experience. I think in terms of the age profile is fantastic. But remember, those players, all the players we've been describing, and we've been talking about them for 18 months, are they getting better? Are they a team? Are they a team with potential? Are they a team in transition? These players now, your Odegaards, your Salibas, your Sakas, they're 40, 50, 100 games into their careers now. And I think now's the time.
Okay, Dave Mooney on Manchester City.
I am joined by Dave Mooney of Blue Moon to talk about Manchester City and matters arising. There's obviously the Community Shield this weekend up against Arsenal. We'll get on to that because from a Manchester City point of view, it's a must-win fixture. Last season defeated by Liverpool and went on to have a season of ignominy, a real poor performance. So they need to lay a marker down early. We will start off, though, talking about Manchester City's business or odd lack of it, Dave.
Yeah.
What's the general feeling among City supporters? It is obviously coming back off a season where the treble was won.
Yeah.
Is the feeling it's all right, they'll have all of this under control, or is the feeling a little bit of, it's dragging on, you know?
Maybe need some bodies in through the door at this stage. I mean, what I would say is that the outgoings haven't happened yet either. The idea, they've lost Mahrez, obviously, but generally the talk was around Laporte, was around Cancelo, was around Walker. None of them have left yet, and there's the possibility that none of them do leave. I think in the case of Joao Cancelo, it probably presents a little bit of a problem because it feels like there is a lot of tension in the room when both he and Guardiola are in the same room. So maybe not ideal to not have that one done. But if Laporte doesn't leave and if Walker doesn't leave, then it's fine. They're good players. I think Laporte is a little bit of an issue if they do actually get Guardiola over the line, because then they've got like 15 centre backs, and I know they're going to play a system where they have centre backs at fullback again, and they do what they did at the end of last season. And that has that they are planning for that. That's not a we haven't got any fullbacks, let's kind of come up with a solution. They're planning to carry on the same way from last season. But it is just dragging on. The latest was that Guardiola could probably be done before the Community Shield, but it could have been done before the final game of preseason, it could have been done before the first game of preseason, it could have been done before they left on the tour. And those stories dragged on and on, so I kind of just wait and see until he's photographed on the website holding up the scarf and the shirt. You're not really convinced it's happening. Kovacic looks like he's been a good kind of neat little buy, but he's got to settle in, and he's not Gundogan, and it's not you've got to kind of work out how to use him. And then you kind of go into next season going, well, they've lost Mahrez. They're not really that keen on replacing him. They like Michael Olise at Crystal Palace, but they're not willing to break the bank for him. They don't think he's a player that they'll go and spend 50, 60, 70, 80 million on if they need to. They're kind of more than happy to go without and to negotiate. And you kind of wonder if just two or three injuries at any point in the season, and you can kind of, you could get yourself into a tricky situation. And I liken it in some ways to the 1920 season where you guys ran away with the league. And City, if you look at City starting 11 through every Premier League game in that season, you go, God, that's a good team. But then in every fourth or fifth one, they really underperformed and didn't play well together. And it was simply because the system had, had a shakeup, and they hadn't planned for, they hadn't replaced Company, and they hadn't kind of got the ducks in order. And yeah, they could have great players move around and fill in a job elsewhere, but it kind of took away from this thing of being greater than the sum of your parts, and they were probably just below the sum of the parts, and that was enough to for Norwich to beat them 3-2 at Carrow Road. For, you know, I literally can't think of any other bad results from that season but that one, but that was the ultimate awesome game. But yeah, Wolves away, Wolves are home. It's the game where you can have all of the ball and then suddenly realise, actually, we played 90 minutes and not created a chance. Why is that? There's so much creative talent on the pitch. And then, like, you look at the following season, they flick a switch, they bring in Ruben Dias, they bring in Nathan Ake, and that is enough to go on and actually reset the team and the structure. So I'm not by any stretch of the imagination saying next season is going to be a disaster or a bad season. It might well be perfectly fine. They might well be able to get through the season with 18 players or whatever it is they've got at the moment. But as fans, we kind of just want a bit more security.
No, just on the security point's interesting, because De Bruyne's obviously, you know, he's been injured, as you already go. It looks to me like there's a move to maybe using Foden a little bit more centrally at times, and I think that could end up suiting him down to the ground. I think it's actually, you know, if there's a year where it looks like it's time for Foden to really kick on and grab...
We all want that to happen, yeah.
Grab the games. It looks like it's this one. But then there is the next sentence of this is, but what if Foden just gets a knock?
Yeah.
If you see that, you know, what if Foden just has a four-weeker dropped in from somewhere, and then and that coincides with where there's the big Champions League group game, say, and suddenly October just looks a bit rocky and it looks hard. And
you always get that week, don't you, at some point where the Champions League group isn't finished and you need to win that midweek game, but then you've got a big game either end of it at the weekend, and I don't know City's fixtures off the top of my head, and I'm a bad fan in that I never work more than a week in advance, so I don't really know who's coming up until next weekend. I know it's Arsenal and then Burnley, but after that I'm starting to struggle. So, like, you always get that week where you have the Champions League game and then, I don't know, Liverpool at Anfield, Chelsea at the Etihad, either side of it, and you're like, oh, God, this is a week. And then De Bruyne is not quite fit yet. Foden picks up a knock and Alvarez is playing all three games in that role. And don't get me wrong, Alvarez is a great player. But it's kind of the stress of having to have the responsibility thrust on you for those three games. Players like De Bruyne can do it because, you know, they've got the experience to do it. Foden, again, not that experienced, but you feel like he's the sort of player that could just be thrust into it and do it. And if those two aren't there, you kind of go, okay, well, it's a big ask for Alvarez to do it. I know he's won the World Cup and he's won pretty much everything, but it's still a new player in this system. And then on top of that, you go, well, Bernardo's playing out wide. Maybe you move him in the middle. Okay, well, now who plays out wide? Alvarez again. Like, it's just the same names that are just rotating in these different positions, and before you know it, you know you're needing Cole Palmer to come off the bench in a big game and change the game. And, you know, as talented as he is as a young lad, he needs to kick on, and he feels like he's not kind of hit that peak yet where he can be trusted to just be thrown in and change a game.
I think I would argue here from what you're saying, Guardiola's taking a bit of time, but as you say, Laporte exists.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like there's, you know, it feels as though because of the wages and the likely fee, Laporte would command, Cancelo would command.
Nobody, it's really weird that, like, Crystal Palace, for instance, turned their nose up at 35 million for Laporte. And I'm just kind of like that. Like, if you can get Aymeric Laporte for 35 million, I think that is an absolute steal. I think I like, from what he can do for you. Without being disrespectful to Crystal Palace, like, Laporte has to agree to go there. You can't just go, okay, we've had this offer, off you go, Aymeric, see you later. But, like, the idea that if City are willing to accept 35 million, there is no club out there that will go, you know what, we'll do that bit of business. That baffles me, that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So you end up in a situation there, Guardiola happens or doesn't happen, there are these other players, as you've said.
Yeah.
they can knock around and they can obviously fill in and do a job. Happy enough up to a point with the Kovacic and Gundogan out thing. That might end up feeling, you know, maybe there's more opportunity there for Phillips over the course of the season. He's occasionally linked away, but nothing looks that nailed down, and you wonder there. And also there's, in amongst all of this, there's Rico Lewis, who got a really good number of appearances in the Premier League last season for Manchester City. Just to be clear for listeners, in the end, Lewis gets himself 14 appearances, 10 starts last season. I'm sure everyone involved would like that to become 15 starts and 20 appearances. Yeah. Because the talent that he's got, but your concern is essentially Mahrez is gone, and there probably does just need to be another attacking option. I mean, that feels like that's the top and tail of the concern.
Yeah, and I mean, like, they're talking about Lewis as being a potential number eight, and I'm like, yeah, good, but like, he is a fullback that's come through the academy, and like, he is 18. let's not kind of just go, okay, well, Rico, you've done really well in your 14 appearances so far. Have a fuck ton of responsibility. You know, it's just like, it doesn't really add up. So, I think, listen, nobody listening has got any sympathy for City in terms of squad size and squad depth, because we all know that City do have great depth. What they don't have at the moment is great size. And I think, you know, we could be looking back on this conversation in May and going, well, that was a ridiculous conversation to have, because they were able to do it again with such a small squad. We know Guardiola likes a small squad. We know kind of that he isn't out there looking to just bolster numbers with bodies through the door. But at the same time, I think that almost feels like fans are in the position of, you've just won a treble, like, go and capitalize on it. Go and assert your dominance by going out there and getting the targets. And I understand it from a business point of view. And for instance, let's the Declan Rice thing with Arsenal. City cut their cloth at 100 million and Arsenal went to 105. And it was just kind of like, the fans' reaction to that was, it's 5 million more, just pay it if you really want him. And you can't get into a position where City are still seen as this club. This is the thing I was saying at the end of last season. People think City spend money like left, right and centre anyway. So what's the point in trying to convince them that they don't? If you're another business and City come in, and if you're another club and City come in, you're not sitting there going, well, these guys are really shrewd with the money. Even though they might have been in the last 5 or 6 years, you're going, let's take these for all we can get. And that attitude is never going to change. So fans will look at that and go, just pay that extra 5 million. And it's a tactic that City have consistently done in the last 5, 6, 7 years. They've walked away from deals that they see as not value for money. They walked away from Van Dijk, and I mean, they could have solved themselves a hell of a lot of hassle for a good few years if they just paid the money for Van Dijk in 2017. But they chose not to. Liverpool paid the money, and then look how that one transfer transformed Liverpool for those next few years. So they're not afraid of walking away from deals in that sense. And I think that is a little bit of a frustration for fans. But, you know, from my point of view, you just kind of trust them to get on with it, because they've been fine. You can't look at the last few years and go, all those deals they've walked away from. If they got them done, then they'd have been better. And it's like, I mean, you're splitting hairs. Maybe they would have been, but you're splitting hairs with what you have achieved and what you might have achieved.
Absolutely. This one on Sunday, the first thing to point out is that there's been a big fundraising push from the banks in Manchester around saying to people, rather than travel to London, I know the kickoff times now move, but rather than travel to London for it, come and watch it here and raise some money. That's gone really well. Raise a good sum.
It's just under 10 grand for the Trussell Trust and the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. So there's still going to be donations. So there's a screening going on at Night and Day Cafe instead. And all the tickets for that have gone to the Trussell Trust. There was a fundraiser that was, if you are not going to the game, even if you're not going to the fundraiser, please stick some money in here and just say, you know, we're not going down. So it's hit just under 10 grand. By the time of the game, we're hoping it has tipped over 10 grand, and there'll be donations on the day as well. So, you know, fingers crossed that it does it. And it's to be honest with you, I think the fan supporting food banks movement has really gathered momentum in the last few years. I know Liverpool's is huge. I know, is it Spirit of Shankly that do a lot of work with them?
Definitely. And they do work around the women's team as well. Food banks in Liverpool, and they were at Pride as well. I saw that.
Yeah, they're a great bunch, and they've supported the Man City fans group as well. And I think it's, I think it's really important that while the country is in the situation that it's in, the work that these guys are, they're just giving up their time to do it and to collect for it. And I think the work that they're doing is utterly incredible. So I'm really, really happy to see that we've raised so much money for them for the first weekend of the season. As for the boycott for the game, it was around the kickoff time. Obviously the kickoff time got moved. And I suspect as much as the push was to still boycott the game, I suspect it's sold out, and I suspect there'll be quite a full Wembley in the end. But you can't knock 10 grand to the Trussell Trust, can you?
Absolutely not. Obviously, it's a game. Last season, it was a competitive match at Leicester, all a little bit odd. I recall this on Wednesday. Arsenal are actually playing this evening, so they haven't thought about fixture congestion before the big one. It's a funny game I think players, I found the pre-season, a lot of teams playing, big teams playing each other to be quite interesting. There's been, I think, a few kerfuffles around bad challenges and stuff like that. And I think that's part of what happens. Genuinely, if you put elite footballers on the pitch against each other, they're going to want to impress. Can't help themselves. And I think that, my genuine opinion is, just like last season, it genuinely wouldn't surprise me if a good game of football breaks out on Sunday.
My slight concern about it all is I just feel City are a little bit underdone so far, and they were a little bit underdone last year. And I feel like what they do is they kind of get themselves done for about October. So this is the one that tends to kind of fall by the wayside a little bit. They for the first time in a long time, they had a good team out last year, to be fair. But for the first time, there's been no summer tournament, and there's been no reason for players to be away. So all the players have actually been on pre-season and kind of had the same motion. So maybe City are in a better position. They lost last year. I thought Liverpool were, to be fair, much better last year. The year before, I thought Leicester were slightly better and nicked it, and that's fine. It was less than a year before. I get my Community Shields mixed up because I never go to them, and I end up just kind of sticking them on the telly and getting annoyed at Sam Matterface. So it'd be interesting to see what he does. I wonder if we'll see a little bit more towards a Premier League lineup than we have done in previous years. I can't remember if City played many youngsters last year. I don't think they did.
It was two awfully strong sides last year, but the game ebbed and flowed massively. For both sides, I thought, actually, in the end. I think it was 1-1 for an extended period. But it was a good game. A good game did break out, and I think that's the most you can hope for.
Yeah,
I'm not going to ask you for a prediction, because what's the point?
It's
a glorified friendly, but it will be on Sunday. Arsenal versus Manchester City may well be the defining fixture of the course of the campaign. We'll wait and see. Thanks a lot to Dave. Let's get back over.
Great stuff there from David. Just very, very quickly before we go over to Luke, Jim. Are you looking forward to Sunday's game? I mean, you're not going into the Community Shield with a trophy, let's be fair about that.
What do you mean, Neil? We won the title.
That's a source of frustration. But are you looking forward to, I really enjoyed the fixture last year, Liverpool versus Manchester City. I thought it was a really good game. I think that occasionally a good game can break out in this. Are you expecting a good game in this one?
I love the Charity Shield, Community Shield, whatever you want to call it. I love it as a game. When my attention moved from the current season to the next season, as it did with three or four games to go, I sort of did want City to win the FA Cup for that very reason, because it meant that we would challenge it. So in that respect, I think Arsenal get more out of it than City do, because I think our preparation's a little bit more advanced than theirs right now, just in terms of business and things like that. But in terms of like putting a marker, I think it'll be great. Yeah, I'm loving it.
Excellent stuff. All right, we are joined by Luke from the 10th Pint podcast to talk to us about Everton. Better or worse than the start of last season? I think it looks a bit better to me. Dan Juma and Young in, Mina, Begovic out, Dyche in, Lampard out.
It's difficult to say, really, without sort of... Again, we've got that issue. We don't have a focal point. We don't have a striker. The whole of the play can be great building up to it. Midfield looks all right. The defence has looked all right in the pre-season games recently. It's just, we just don't have a striker. And everything breaks down. Mope, he does try his hardest, but you can't fault him in that sense, but it's just not good enough. His end product, when you've got that one chance in a Premier League game, especially against the big teams, he just can't take it. And it's worrying, to be honest, because we're linked with a 19-year-old from Sporting Lisbon. I think he's already injured, and then the talks are stalling, and you're there the next day that, oh yeah, he's coming. It's just, you don't really know where you're at with Everton. And that's been the theme for a few seasons. I think that's why the fans are frustrated as ever, to be honest.
On the I mean, he is the thing, Calvert-Lewin, isn't he? You know, the extent to which... Does it just need to be written off now? Or do you think, Evan, let me rephrase this. Do you think if there was more money sloshing around for the Blues to be able to spend for one reason or another, do you think it would just be written off now and it would become anything we get from him is a bonus? Go from there at best, because it does seem like it's always this element of a bit of jam tomorrow. Calvert-Lewin might get himself back fit. When he does, he's capable of this, he's capable of this, he's capable of this. It just seems to me to be, you know, at this point, it almost seems too much pressure on him and his fitness, if you sort of know what I mean.
Yeah, it's the same with young players as well. You can't, like, embed players, give them a chance at Everton because we need results straight away. Like, for example, if we had a striker and then Calvert-Lewin's coming back maybe last 20 minutes of a game where you're 2-0 up at home, it's very rare that we get them opportunities. And as soon as he might be 80% fit, he's thrown straight back in. But to what's been a relegation dogfight, really. And then he's just straining himself. And he's making the injuries more severe. And it's sort of like a vicious circle. But I think then you look at us and you think, oh, why are they buying a 19-year-old unproven striker with the money that they do have? Is there not someone else you could get a little bit more experienced where you're guaranteed goals? Because again, say he's had four games, he hasn't scored, fans will be on his back.
That was theoretically at least more pay to a degree. I mean, he's always been a bit patchy with goals, but more pay was more of a sure thing, and that's not worked either. So it is like, how do you win in this scenario if you're Everton? It's difficult, isn't it?
I think you've got to look at Calvert-Lewin as a luxury player, and you've got to bring someone in, relatively experienced, proven goal scorer, even if he only gets 6 to 8 goals in that season. Like, Mopay scored one league goal last season, so anything better than that. And then maybe if he comes off the bench, Mopay, but again, it's the financial, not the financial fair play, but it's how much money we're willing to spend. We need to ship players out. Did we get rid of Calvert-Lewin? I think Roma was sniffing around him last week. I don't know how true that is, but it's a tough one. It's a hard dilemma to solve, to be honest.
Yeah, I think the Mopay thing is interesting, because I think he's burnt out so many Evertonian heads now that you can't imagine it's going to go that well for him if he starts the season like he finished the last one, because you can almost feel it in the ground. Obviously, I'm not there, but you can kind of almost, you know, speaking to any Evertonian, there's almost a collective sigh when he either comes on or he misses a chance. And that's got to be affecting him as well. So from a confidence point of view, you can imagine he's pretty low. The Calvert-Lewin thing, obviously, if they can get him on the pitch, you can tell that there's still a player in there. I know we had that really kind of purple patch where he looked great and he was threatening the kind of, you know, the international scene and stuff, maybe getting in a few squads, and then he tailed off again. Maybe the supply line changed. But I think you see in those performances, certainly the Brighton game away, what he brings to that Everton scene, where everyone all of a sudden's feeding off him. He's great in the air. He's great at bringing others into play. He's strong. He's clever as well. And I think those games towards the back end of the season, there's no doubt him being reintroduced back into the Everton team kept us up. You know, we go to Leicester, get the results. I know he misses a chance on that night, a really good one. But I think having that focal point was absolutely huge. It looks to me, from the outside looking in, there's a bit of, we're banking on Luton and Sheffield United being so bad, and maybe one other team that will be okay on that basis. But in terms of a bigger plan, it's hard to see what Everton's plan is, given the financial kind of restrictions they're operating under.
My dear old father-in-law is a massive Blue Nose. And we've talked a lot towards the end of last season and in the close season about what sort of business they needed to do in terms of their financial restrictions. And the one thing I did say was that I said, I think it'd be really interesting if Deitch could just get a couple of a really seasoned pros in who of the kind of calibre of a James Milner, not Milner, because Milner's not going to do that, right? But the kind of player where they come in and their standards, just their standards of everything, their standards of punctuality, their standards in training, their ability to coach in game and in training type situations. I think a couple of those, and it's very interesting, obviously, they got Ashley Young in.
He's very much one of them.
Very much one of them. And the talk around Johnny Evans was quite interesting as well, but obviously it didn't happen, but
still could.
It still could, right? Behind them, you've actually got some quite good players. Seamus has stayed. You know, I obviously I have a personal interest in Iwobi because of where he came from, and I think I actually think Alex Iwobi's on, yeah, probably been your most consistent player.
I think he divides the fan base a lot, though.
To be fair, though, I could divide the Goodison Park fan base. You know, it's not the most difficult thing to do, Luke. Is it? Do you know what I mean?
100%, yeah.
You know, now the Mopé thing, interesting, but the DCL thing is that he is absolutely a luxury player. So if someone's going to come in and give you the money that's going to alleviate you, just so that you can bring in the right player, for me. There's the existential crisis that Everton fans face at the moving forward into the season is around the manager.
Yeah.
Because the manager came in and did an astonishing job as it was, and you moved away. Okay, you still could have gone tits up on the final day, but it was never going to happen. You know, and that there was nothing in that final game.
Yeah.
I don't know whether or not he's got the points per game to change things drastically.
I don't think things need to change drastically, though. I don't think Evertonians expect a mid-table finish, really. I think it's, again, we realise the situation we're in. We're not getting ahead of ourselves, but it has been two seasons in a row now. And you think it could be third time, unlucky rather than lucky, because the recruitment's not great. Dan Juma and Young, I think he looks very fit in pre-season. You can tell he's just a wily old fox, isn't he, really? Dan Juma, I haven't really seen much of. I don't really think... You know what role they're going to play him in. He played it up front against Stoke, and then he hasn't really played in any other pre-season games.
He wasn't great for Tottenham, was he?
No, but I think a lot of players at Charleston's been like that.
No, the Tottenham brief sojourn there is almost irrelevant because they were the saddest club that the world's ever seen.
Yeah, and still are.
What strikes me is, Luke, to sort of err on the side of the positives, because it's too easy to sort of see the negatives if you're not careful. Like, you've just got to keep a couple of those players who he had absolutely in peak form at the back end of last season going. You mentioned Iwobi a little bit in and out by the end of the campaign, but if you can get Iwobi back to good form, McNeil, Decore is another one. You know, he began to get stuff, I thought, out of Onana. Gay, I thought, went up a couple of levels towards the end of the campaign. They got Tarkowski, the best version of him, I think. But you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't... I think from an Everton perspective, the thing that would worry me is what happens if, with a couple of injuries, is a really, really valid concern at the minute, looking at that squad. But where he gets them to it, I think, is where if he can keep getting the best out of some of those footballers, then there are points to be had.
They are, like, certainly Dwight McNeil, certainly. He proved a lot to the fans at the start when he came in last season. He's not the quickest winger. He's a bit one-footed. He's only good with his left foot. And to be honest, a lot of people talking about how good he would have been, like, standing balls up in the box for Calvert-Lewin. But again, as I've already mentioned, it's that supply line's fine. But if you don't have the end product, you can't put a ball into the box to Mopé in the air. And that's where we're struggling again. Everything comes back to the striker. I think the midfield's fine. I think Onana's certainly got the assets to be a good player. Yeah. I think he needs to prove it a little bit more sometimes. You'll see him, he'll do play a good pass instead of following into the box. You'll sort of admire his work. But he had injury problems, to be honest. It wasn't a bad first season, but the defence look all right, to be honest. Michael Keane's got a mistake in him, but him and Tarkowski together at the end of last season, they were quite solid, to be honest. I can't really ask for more from them. The fullbacks again, Patterson hasn't been brilliant in pre-season, and you've got an aging Seamus Coleman again come back from injury, so
and
that's sad.
Mikalenko, I think people began to lose a bit of faith in as the season wore on.
I think it's one of them. I don't really know what he's good at. Is he good going forwards? Is he good defending? He sort of gets stuck in between. But again, I think it's confidence. And throughout the team, it's like the culture of the club. It's just quite negative. It's hard even when we're speaking about positive to speak about them.
Fullback is the worst position to play at Goodison Park, isn't it? Because you're right by the touchline.
Yeah. You've probably got to give the manager a bit of credit with the likes of McNeil, because it looked like he was on a bit of a tough path, McNeil. I don't think he was particularly a fan's favourite.
No, he wasn't.
But then the manager comes in, obviously knows him from previous days, and all of a sudden he's getting a tune out of him. I think with someone like him, he becomes pretty valuable because he's quite flexible in terms of he can play multiple positions. I think the Onana one's interesting because you wonder how long he's willing to stick around for, because I agree with Luke, he's a talented footballer, he's very raw and he's got plenty of yellow cards in him, if not reds at times, some of the challenges he makes, but you can see he's got a fairly high ceiling, I think, under the right manager. I was interested to see that they may let Damari Gray go, given that I know he's a bit of a flatter to deceive and he's not consistent by any stretch, but they haven't really got any creative kind of fulcrums at the club, have they? So it's another one who's got the ability to pop up with a goal. I don't think Dyche was particularly kind of keen on him, but then he started playing him a little bit through the centre at times, yeah, out of necessity. But again, it's another player who, you know, has got maybe the ability to provide assists going out the door. But he is one of those lads who you just think he's one good game in five, though, isn't he? But,
yeah, he is. He's, yeah, one of them, though. If you get, say, if you get 12 million for him, we only got him for 1.5, it's good business. And then if you reinvest that maybe in two players, you could look at it that way, because he's not consistent. He's good on his day. He's got a little bit about him, but he doesn't show enough. He reminds me a little bit of Gerard Deulofeu.
Where's he finished? Where he finished the season? Was it right back? Where's he been using Garner in pre-season?
Well, he finished at right back, but he come back quite late as well, because he was away with the under England under 21s. Yep. But I've sent him a field, I'd say, his best position. I think you're just plugging a gap, putting him at right back. Like, yep, he'd done a job, especially in the Bournemouth game, but you see him, like, he sprays passes about. He needs to be in the middle of the park.
I think that's the other issue, isn't it? That the likes of Garner, who's come back late, and I know they were concerned about Dan Juma's kind of fitness, yeah, levels as well, maybe as a kind of, you know, consequence if he wasn't getting much time at Spurs. But I think, yeah, you want to be getting some of those players who you know have got maybe some decent output, kind of up to speed very, very quickly. Because, you know, if you start off poorly, you can imagine a scenario where it gets quite on top quite, yeah, quickly. I'm interested to see how they take someone like Ashley Young, because he is a good pro, been around the block, knows all the tricks, but he's not one to get you really excited. And I can just imagine, I don't know, maybe it might not end that well for him, I don't know.
On the first, on the fast start question, Luke, I'm struck by Everton's first four before the international break. It's Fulham at home, Villa away, Wolves at home and Sheffield United away. I've watched and mostly admired Sean Dyche's work for many a year. He's a man who works out the games where points are available.
Yeah.
And I think before he's seen a fixture list, he'd have probably looked at three of them and gone, they're where we need to do our business. They need to start. I'm not saying they need to start with three wins or, yeah, four wins or anything like that, but they do need to get results in those early games. And Dyche is a master of that, I'd say.
You've got to start as you mean to go on, especially at Goodison against a Fulham team that done well but fell off at the end of last season.
And they sold the striker and all that sort of
exactly,
stuff.
Exactly. Like, you've got question marks over the manager too, whether he was going to Saudi maybe. But it's just second season syndrome with Fulham as well. Maybe you've got, yep, to start. You've got to win that first game. Everton's a fan base that it's very quickly we get excited about things, but it can also go the other way just as quick. I think if you get a point at Villa and win against Fulham, that's seen as a good start. Maybe if you do lose another game then, because we're not expected to win every game. We should be winning. Like when we were with Moyes, we'd win the home games and we weren't very good away. We never have been. But as long as you win them home games, pick up the points that you should do, I think we'll be all right. But
you remember that though, Luke, 2 years ago, under Rafa, you had a great start to the season.
Yeah.
You know, you were top and we were bottom.
Yeah.
But I do think, on the basis of those four games that you're talking about, potentially 12 points. But I mean, potentially, unlikely, but potentially, yeah, you get anywhere near those kind of numbers, you're 25% of your target points to keep you happily sort of mid-table.
I remember last year, though, Fulham coming to Goodison, and everyone was thinking they were in poor form. Everyone was thinking Everton are going to punch these on the nose, and Fulham came into town and just battered rolled them. And then, yeah, going to Aston Villa now does not look like I've had a laugh under that manager.
No. I mean, the one thing I would say about
that, you can flip it, Jim, is also saying,
what I would say, and I'll go to Luke first and bring you all in on this. At the minute, looking at the bottom sides, and I'm going all the way up to ninth last season here, it looks like Brentford will be weaker, Fulham will be weaker, yeah, West Ham are currently weaker, Palace are weaker, Wolves all look poorer than last season, Burnley, Sheffield and Luton on paper look poorer than the three sides that have gone in terms of the quality of footballer at their disposal, and Luton and Sheffield don't look like they're going to put much more money in between now and the end of the window. Burnley slightly different. Forest and Everton static, maybe ever so slightly improved in there. I mean, a lot of this is harsh, it's out of Brentford's control, the Tony situation, yeah, but the truth of it is they haven't got him. And Luke, I just feel a little bit like, you know, from the Everton perspective, and not just the Everton perspective, but a few of these other sides. Like, I think, for instance, Palace can have a bit of a funny year where they experiment with a thing or two because of how poor a lot of the other teams look. I don't think Everton are in that camp yet. But it wouldn't take much, I think, to get a bit of a cushion. And that's why, you know, those early fixtures there, Fulham themselves, you know, they've got work to do, yeah, right now. You know, Wolves have got work to do. Sheffield look like they've got work to do, but they might not even do it. I think it'll be a good time to play those teams. Put Villa to one side, because I think the gap between top and bottom might be as big as it's been in years.
Yeah.
The gap between the top eight and everyone else might be absolutely massive. But all those other sides that I've mentioned there, that are either poor or the sides that have come up are poorer than their counterparts, Everton should be, you know, if they remain static, yeah, I think there's points to be had.
Yeah, I do. It was a bit like that last season. We were hoping for other teams to just be worse than us rather than we're better than them. I think we've seen with about 8 games to go, maybe around April time, I think there was only 8 points between like the bottom 10, something like that. It was when Vieira just left Palace and they were in free-for-all, but then obviously they like perked up a bit under Hodgson. But I think it'll be a similar season in that sense, to be honest. Not a lot of teams have improved much. A lot of them have regressed rather than progressed.
Yeah.
And I think we are static, really. We haven't really lost any players. We obviously lost Tom Davis, Begovic, Mina. But Mina was just one of them. When he played, he was boss. But then when he didn't, he was out for weeks. So yeah. I think we're quite similar, to be honest. And I think, obviously, with the training methods of Dyche, that he has hard pre-seasons. And I think the players will be a lot fitter. They have looked a lot fitter under Dyche as well, rather than Lampard. And I think he's harsher with a few of them. As we said with Damari Gray, you can't just turn up every other week. You've got to be on it every week. I think personally we'll be all right, hopefully.
It's intriguing that as it stands, Ian, you're looking at those sides at the bottom, and you know, I've not included Bournemouth because the new manager is such a left field appointment and he feels like such a risk, and they invested well last January and you feel as though he's got players to work with. But almost everyone else, when I was looking down last season's league table a few days ago, I was thinking, no one here is making me think, oh God, they're going to be good.
No, I wouldn't disagree. And at the start of this segment, I think I kind of alluded to the fact that I think there's almost a banking on 3 teams being worse. And you can see why that might be the case, because Luton and Sheffield United, I mean, I'm not sure what Sheffield United are doing. It looks like they've just almost, I wouldn't say given up, but, you know, all the noises coming out of that club are they're not willing to make any kind of serious moves. And, you know, Luton don't look like a Premier League club at any level, you know, kind of.
Might not be a nice place to go. Neither of those. What I would say is, not dissimilar to Goodison, although I think Evan have got better players than both, but neither of them will be a good place to go. Kenilworth Road and Bramall Lane will let you know what they're about.
Certainly early on, and you do get that with a lot of promoted clubs. They come up, they have a real go, don't they, for maybe 5 or 6 games.
It's hard to do that in December when you keep getting beat.
Exactly. You look like you may get somewhere, and then you're on the couple of a... You're on the end of a couple of hidings, and then it just becomes a lot harder. And as you say, as the season wears on, you've seen it loads of times with teams that have come up, it just becomes a bit of a grind.
And even for the crowds.
And the better teams settle in, the better players settle in, and they just start picking you apart. And it's hard to come back from that, and you are relying on, you know, a little bit of luck going your way, the bounce of the ball, all that kind of stuff. So it's interesting. You mentioned Forest as well, and there's rumours that one or two of their better players are attracting attention. So, you know, the likes of Spurs, if they all of a sudden do lose a Harry Kane and they come knocking for a Johnson, for instance, and he leaves, that's been rumoured.
Gibbs-White.
I'm not sure that he's kind of, he's not a Harry Kane replacement in terms of style or anything like that, but he's an exciting footballer. So I think, you know, there's still work to be done in the transfer market as well. So the next kind of, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks are going to be really interesting.
I think that, just going back to Dan Juma for a moment, right? He is, of all those teams, he's like the only player amongst that whole cluster of players that's got any Champions League experience. You saw 6 goals in the Champions League, which is, so, you know, there are little slivers.
And he's going to get his game at Everton. Dyche is going to pick him.
Of course, he's going to play a lot of football. He's going to play a lot of football. And strikers, to be fair, you know, they thrive on momentum and that sort of thing. I mean, you look at Fulham's business. I mean, they've signed Jimenez, haven't they? I mean, and, you know, I mean, wow, on paper, 1 in 3 nearly, you know, in terms of goals, but he's just the wrong age, isn't he? You know,
and has not looked the same football since the poor injury.
Apart from when he came to Anfield.
Yeah, well, that day
we couldn't get fucking near him.
Yeah. but West Ham have done no business.
Yeah.
Other than players out the door. Well, I mean, you know, they're sitting on a big load of fat cash. But, I think you're absolutely right what you say, Neil, in the sense of none of those teams look better. I think there's going to be a same old, you know, bit of a bun fight going on with them all. The thing I'd say about Luton, it's such a shame, you know, that they're not even going to be able to start their campaign on time because of the things. But that, my friends, is karma, because in the 80s, when you ban away fans, that's what you get.
There you are. Jim nearly segued nicely into Andy Middleton talking about West Ham.
Joined by Andy Middleton to talk about West Ham United, who at this moment in time are going to be weaker going into this season than they were last. No Declan Rice, no Masuaku, and no Lanzini. All have moved on. Obviously, Declan for the big sum, Masuaku and Lanzini just for small amounts or free in Lanzini's case. Andy, it looks to me like West Ham are just trying to find value everywhere, and I'm trying to find value everywhere they're not able to action anywhere. Is that fair?
I think that's more than fair. That's the kindest way I've seen it said in this whole close season. I said I'm planning to use this as a therapy session because there's no no transfers to talk about. So, I don't know where to start in terms of a club who doesn't know what it's doing. We appear to have two completely different strategies at play on the same transfer committee, and the ensuing melee and doing nothing, I think, is just an output of that. And I'm not really sure how that changes when you've got two people who want completely different things.
So who are the two people? What is it that they want?
Well, I think you've got Tim Steinden, who's been brought in with a very, very strong record as a technical director in Germany, very much in the kind of, Red Bull type of model. I nicknamed the Pearl Diver for the quality of players he uncovers and tremendous amount of European contacts and finds young players that provide real value. And you have a manager who's I don't like the word dinosaur, so let's say more traditional in the last year of his contract, who only wants to buy proven, and a lot of the time British, but proven Premier League players, which costs a lot of money. I don't know how you ever expected a club would expect that to marry up. You've got someone who's looking at value and younger players and players through his vast array of European contracts that he thinks real value and will turn into the next Declan. And the player manager who's only got a year left on his contract, who wants to buy people that in his mind will hit the ground running and priced accordingly. For all the noise is coming out, whether you read the Telegraph or the Guardian or speak to anyone at the club, that's the problem. We've got a transfer committee of about four or five people. Moyes has the ultimate embargo because he can say, well, if you buy those players, I won't play them.
Yeah.
I'm not saying managers would be that childish, but you could. I still remember when I had to watch Hayden Mullins play while Javi Mascherano sat on the bench. So it's possible. Every day it's like they're going to rush about and do some business. We had the Borges deal that was done and then got stolen by Ajax because allegedly we weren't keen on the agent's fee. I don't know how much of that was true, but everyone was saying that was a done deal that he's now gone to Ajax. Word out the club after that was Moyes didn't fancy him anyway. So I don't know. As I said, with Moyes players, we get linked to the likes of McTominay and us going back in for Maguire. And the Steinen players are people like Fofana at Monaco, who I think looks a great player. And you get a 24-year-old French international versus, in the case of where we're changing James Ward-Prowse, a 28-year-old, no sell-on value, probably going to be his last contract. And the 28-year-old costs a lot more money than the 24-year-old. So I don't know how you square that circle.
When you're thinking about trying to square that circle, it throws us back into the conversations you and I were having last season about Moyes and about whether or not his time at West Ham was up, and that was allowing for the idea of the marvellous night winning the trophy. There was maybe a moment to say, you know what, it's not going to get much better for me than the way in which it's been for the last 3 years here. Two really good league finishes, avoided relegation year one, year 0.5, and then this year we've gone, and yes, it's not been great domestically, but we won this trophy. So, for me, that still remains almost the crux of the West Ham question. If you're saying it's changed behind the scenes, but he's still there, then it feels like West Ham are almost falling between eras when they've had the crowning moments of the previous era.
Yeah, and that's, to me, how it looks. It looks they brought in a director of football who was highly rated, allegedly on Tottenham shortlist and a number of other clubs, which is meant to be what we're buying moving forward. And we've got that fallout of first of all, we had the coaches leaving, and I heard Warburton saying about why he left, which still remains great friends with Moyes, but they were falling out a lot because Warburton likes a more progressive and attacking style of football. But I think the worst thing is you've got that horrible manager in the last year of his contract. I remember when Ferguson announced his retirement and United had their worst season going, because players are players. Is this my last year here? Will the new manager fancy me? A manager in the last year of a contract with no sign of renewal and no talk of renewal, I think creates massive uncertainty at club. And I think you're right. If he could have gone out on a high and the club could have said, we're taking a new direction with this manager in this, And I think that's part of the upset at the club about losing Declan. You know, we didn't lose Declan to a better performing football club. We lost Declan to a club with a project and a vision of where they were taking that football club and how they expected to perform in doing it. You know, 2-3 years ago, Arsenal finished below us in the league. And I think that's the difference between having a long-term strategy, a long-term vision and something people can buy into, and the short-termism, which understandably Moyes is looking for in the transfer market because it's his last year at the club potentially.
And within that, there is the idea that right now, if you wanted to say West Ham were a project, they'd be quite an attractive one. There's a lump sum of money burning some holes in there. There's Europa League football. There's a, you know, I can name 3 or 4 really impressive names of footballers who, you know, you look at what Aguirre did when he was at Ron. You look at the nature of the footballer that, you know, Jared Bowen is going to go on and be. You look at the fact that Lucas Paqueta is 25 as part of all of this. You know, this is there's a nucleus, isn't there, of footballers that a progressive manager might find really exciting to work with.
Yeah, there's 6, 7, 8. You know, I think Zuma and Aguirre at the back. I think Kerr at the back end of the season showed his worth. Depending on the thing, Emerson is a decent Premier League player, and as you said, Paqueta and Bowen, you've got some real talent in there. So there is a project you could kind of get your head around, and I think the idea, I don't know. I mean, the thing about Fofana, which has been going on for weeks, that we didn't fancy him, and I don't know if anyone saw the Arsenal Monaco game where he was then looked one of the best players on the pitch, and allegedly now we do. Now I can't believe some of the people at our club are so blinkered and short termist at a good pre-season friendly performance would make him suddenly attractive. But I know they were saying it was people like him that was on Steinden's shortlist, and people like, you know, James Ward-Prowse and Harry Maguire that was on Moyes. And I even see today or yesterday, they were talking about going back in with another mid-bid for Maguire. I don't, you know, Steinden's put up a couple of centre-backs that are 26 and 28, and one's a German international, and we're bidding for a 30-year-old guy for Man United at twice the price. It just doesn't. It's as you said, it's fundamentally different strategies, and I don't know how that circle is squared. And I think a lot of the people, if everything from you read from social media to an output in the press, that I think honestly is what genuinely concerns the fans. That when you have two people at the club who seem to want different things in the transfer market, the manager will be the ultimate winner. But what, to buy a bunch of 30-year-old players with no resale value, spending the rice money on that, doesn't leave much for the next manager.
You say that, just on that though, you say that the manager will be the eventual winner. There is obviously people above both the technical director and the manager. And that's where, you know, they've got to think about the club as an ongoing concern.
Yeah. Well, you'd hope 30. So.
Well, you'd like to, and that's... You know, I think that you can look at West Ham as being relatively well run and calm across the last 2 or 3 years. That's, you know, I think that feels like a fair assessment. Yeah. Some stuff's not gone perfectly. For instance, it feels like money might have been wasted on Cornet and Scamacca last summer, but at least Cornet and Scamacca, you know, Cornet's 26, Scamacca 24, 25. You know, that if it seems to me as though the smart money is always on the younger players with the resale value. And if you're being counted, you'd think that's where you'd end up.
Yeah, and I think Cornet is a good example. I think actually he's a good player. I think without his injuries and if he gets a chance, he's had a pre-season. I think he'll have a good season this season if he gets a chance and he's played. Scamacca, I think, will end up going for he clearly doesn't get on. And I think, you know, that's the concern of when you look at buying the players and how it's done in both Sebastian Haller and in Scamacca. We've had clearly what are two quality players. You look at Haller's goal scoring record since he left us.
Yeah.
And you look at Scamacca before he came to us, and the fact he's wanted by Roma and Inter Milan and Atlanta, and he's clearly a very rated centre forward that for some reason we don't get a tune out of. So, you know, there's bits around there that I just think concern people where we seem to have these different strategies going on. So Bowen, for instance, gave rise to this alleged strategy of young talent out of the Championship that's hungry, and that's what we'll do, which appears to have changed. It's got to be proven Premier League quality. We brought Flynn down, so I don't think it's even a fair crack at the whip. Bowen, I know we paid 15-odd million for him. Fulham paid 20 million for Paulinho, which was, you know, someone we wouldn't go near because he wasn't a proven Premier League player, who now we were willing to pay 60 million for after his first year in the Premier League. So I think if you look at Fulham and you look at Brighton and you look at Brentford and you look at these clubs, that is a model. If you've got someone in those positions with real scouting networks around Europe who really knows what they're doing and can spot a player, that is the way clubs are going. If you're not at a very top level and you don't have a nation state backing you. So I do think that is the way we need to go. And I think a lot of fans were excited when Steinen came in and thought, looked at his track record and players he had uncovered. And, you know, we were going to look a little bit like a Brighton and a Brentford. But with a manager in his last year, who probably doesn't want that model because he's only got a year left. Just seems a bit of a mismatch at the owner level, but
we will see.
Anyway, that's my therapy session done. That's my rant.
Your therapy session done. I am intrigued by that first game away at Bournemouth with their new manager, who's very, very aggressive indeed. But then that could play into David Moyes' hands. Thank you very much to Andy. That game is coming first weekend of the season. We'll be speaking to Andy through the season here on the Friday show. Hope you enjoyed that.
Great stuff from Andy. Back with Luke, Jim and Ian. And Ian, you and I spoke on Monday, so we'll loop it back around. Mel Reddy reported on Tuesday, Liverpool wanting two midfielders and a left-sided defender. The current names in the frame are Romeo Lavia, who we have talked about, and Andre Trindade, who has appeared from nowhere from Fluminense, although, you know, I've been talking about him for weeks because I am indeed that sort of idiot. Defender seems unknown, and the sort of defender that they want, I think they're going to have to compromise on. They seem committed on Colwell. Well, the main thing is time is just of the essence for Liverpool here. If they want three footballers, they're going to have to crack on.
Yeah, I'm surprised nearly we're at this stage now where we're still not seeing more come through the door. I think we all thought we'd been in a slightly better position recruitment-wise. You know, it feels like a long time ago since those first two got done.
So Bosley, I think, was early July, wasn't he? So it's a month.
Yeah. You just expected them to kick on from there. And I know they've had stuff coming in from Saudi in terms of dealing with those bids. But, you know, we're not in a world where you can only do one thing at once. You know, why can't Liverpool be kind of working on those deals to bring people in? And I'm sure they'll say they are, but it just feels very static, very slow. You know, do we expect to see, you know, Lavia come through the door? Maybe, but, you know, there have been some noises there that, you know, Liverpool aren't prepared to go near the asking price and they're at a bit of a standoff now. But again, that all feels like it's taking a little bit too long. I understand negotiation and you've got to kind of, you know, hold your nerve to a point. But, you know, if you're the manager, you need these players through the door now. So it feels like if they were going to go and knock on Southampton's door, they probably could have done it a little bit sooner if that's where they were going to land, because, you know, you now are staring down the barrel of less than 2 weeks at the start of the season and Liverpool haven't really got anyone that can play in that defensive midfield role. And with all the best will in the world, and I really like Curtis Jones, I just think it's almost a little bit unfair to be playing some of those teams we're going to be playing and exposing them to some of that when he will be learning on the job. I think on the flip side, to talk about maybe some plus points, if it is the lad from South America, you know, Tim Vickery was talking about him today, and I think it feels like there's loads in there in terms of his skill set, what he could provide. Gets about the pitch really, really well, good in the tackle, likes taking the ball in tight spaces. How they play is quite interesting in terms of they play with a high line, they're quite front foot, they get a lot of men ahead of the ball as well, so we're used to kind of dealing with that. Now don't get me wrong, it's a different level, but taking it off the goalkeeper with people up his back and stuff like that, he's very comfortable with that part of the game. So I think someone like that feels like, you can see why Liverpool have maybe got an interest. Now, I don't know what his true level is, but Tim Vickery's point was there's lots and lots of clubs across Europe who've had a look at this kid and they're really, really keen on him. So I don't think Liverpool will be the only name in the frame here. But the more I've heard about him, I know you've spoken about him quite a bit on the Anfield Wrap as well, the more I like what I hear. But, you know, obviously that's going to then translate to this league if he comes over. So, yeah, and in terms of the defender, I don't think we're any the wiser, are we?
I think I'll just come back to you on Lavia and Trindade. The thing that strikes, there's a couple of things that have struck me all the way through looking at Liverpool's business. Lads who can pass, just looking at from a stats point of view, lads who can pass well under pressure, looks like part of it, that's the way Trindade is described. Lavia, we saw last season's got tons of pace, and I'm often one who likes, you know, I like, for instance, to go use Fabinho as an example, or Rodri, I like a lad who's 6'3", 6'4", who sits in the middle of the midfield for you to win your battles. But I wonder if Liverpool are looking here for, no, we want pace in the middle of the park, we need recovery pace with the way in which we're playing. And it's the pace part that sort of has now struck me for both Lavia and Trindade, that Liverpool could be looking at it going, you know what, that's the thing that you need. More than the other stuff, you need to have footballers who can get back in at real pace.
I think you're right. And the Trindade point was around the fact that he's playing in a team that at times does get very exposed, and he's got to cover the ground, and he's got to cover the ground really, really quickly. And I think that's very much part of what he kind of offers a team. And I think they're both really comfortable in terms of taking the ball on the turn as well. And I think how Liverpool play, again, you can see why they've got eyes on those two players. You know, I was impressed with Lavia when I saw him last season. Yes, there are one or two mistakes in there, but listen, he's 19 years of age. If he comes to us, he's still going to make one or two mistakes. That's obvious. But he is a footballer with a high ceiling. And they both look like players who have got the ability and the capability of hitting another level. And I think that's why Liverpool will be keen.
Liverpool look, though, Luke, sure, with one eye from an Everton point of view, like goals are abundant, but the flip side is they've looked as though they're capable of conceding and giving soft goals away for over 12 months now. And that's the part that you must be looking at as a Blue, thinking, well, long may that continue. And it doesn't, unless Liverpool get their absolute first 11 out. And even if they do, it doesn't look like it's changing anytime soon.
It doesn't, but I think pre-season at times, it can be misleading. It is about fitness. You've got to remember it's about fitness. It's about trying things. I just think the players, as soon as that first game comes, you just click into action. I think especially with Van Dijk now as captain, he's been a leader around the place anyway. Even if he's not someone that screams and shouts at someone, it's just his presence. I think we've seen not so much last season, but in previous years, especially one of the first years where he come in, like players didn't want to go near him, players don't even want to attack him because he just has that aura and presence. Even as an Everton fan, you think, oh, Mope up against Van Dijk, you'd rather just not watch it. You'd rather the ball just not go there. I think him being a leader, obviously Trent being vice-captain also, might not be part of the defence this season, but may well be as a traditional right-back. I think you've got the leaders in that defensive line, and once they sort themselves out, obviously attacking-wise, you're great. So I think you'll be fine, unfortunately.
The thing about Liverpool right now is that if we sit here in the Anfield Wrap, and there's obviously some reticence about the business that's been done, and it feels a little bit incomplete. That is the reality for a lot of teams that are outside the Champions League. And it was certainly the way it was for Arsenal for many, many years. And I don't want to sound like overly smug about it, but I also think that most other teams in the Premier League would look at Liverpool's squad and go, I wouldn't mind having them, you know? So it is a little bit half full, half empty in terms of where you think you are. And we have just talked about the very fact that so many clubs haven't completed their business. And again, that is the reality for the teams outside those teams that are...
And even those from sites in the Champions League, United.
United, absolutely.
Yeah, City are weird still, as Dave Mooney was saying before.
Completely. It feels to the outsider like, as you say, the big questions still remain. I certainly still think that Liverpool will be there or thereabouts in the mix.
Mix for what, Jim? Top four?
Top four, absolutely. Absolutely, no. Ian. 100%. I've talked outside of here about the comparisons I feel about second phase Jürgen. Reminds me very much of second phase Wenger. Second phase Wenger on paper was painful to watch, but remember, it was going into the new stadium, it was the fronting up, all of that, but he still consistently qualified for the Champions League, and people are quick to overlook the fact that they didn't win another title. They won the FA Cups at the end of his tenure, but we remained competitive. And for Jürgen, Perhaps he was a little bit sentimental with some of those players, and maybe he could have moved some of them on, or certainly brought in the reinforcements they needed perhaps earlier in the cycle. But it's Jürgen Klopp and it's Liverpool Football Club. It's still the most difficult place to go and get a result in Europe, 100%, right? Fortress Anfield is still that place, in my opinion, right? And you look at that on paper now, okay, reflecting on bad results last season at Anfield, it wasn't that place at times, but you had some horrible squad issues, you know, in terms of it, you know, injuries and things like that. And maybe some of those decisions that Jürgen was perhaps a little bit sentimental about have kind of now been forced on him, and you've just got to embrace that. The one thing we do know about the way that managers like Jürgen Klopp set up their teams is it doesn't become the age, it becomes the mileage, you know, as much as anything else. And so I think whatever the freshness is around the McAllisters and the like, and Andre, if you get him in, it feels exciting to me if you're a Liverpool fan. It feels very much half full, not half empty.
I mean, it won't be dull watching us this season, that's for sure, no. Because we will have the ability to put teams to the sword in certain games, but my issue is...
Beat United 7-0, man.
I know, but my issue is... But then go lose to Bournemouth 1-0, and that's the thing. That doesn't appear...
But still be in punching distance of the top four, that's my point.
I know, but there's a reality check there, because, you know, it was only the season before last, Liverpool were fighting on all fronts, and they were going for league titles, and then they don't go and make the top four, and now we're talking about maybe just at this moment in time being in the conversation. It's a tough one to accept, but if they don't do any more business, and I think they will do business, obviously, because they're being linked with players, but they've got to pull the trigger soon. But those lads are then going to come in and settle in. And I think at the minute, you look at a team that you can get at pretty easy in a fairly simplistic manner. So if you're looking at some of our pre-season, and I think Luke's pointed out his pre-season, about fitness, shape, all that kind of stuff. But there are teams that are just able to play a simple ball over the top, and they're in. And they're fucking in on our back line. And that's something that was happening last season. And it's something that you can already sniff and smell that it's going to be a problem again unless they tweak it. And it just feels a little bit like we are going to be very susceptible to getting punched,
Ian,
in certain football matches.
But Ian, there's only one team in the country that I think you can safely say that's not the case with. Every other team in the country, including mine, are susceptible in some way to some kind of clever defensive shape or a job on a certain player in the side. There's only Manchester City and their embarrassment of riches that would appear to be impervious to criticism in that respect. Liverpool will be there or thereabouts, I guarantee it.
There we are. Upbeat from Jim at the end. Very kind of him. Thank you very much to Luke as well, and to Dave and to Andy. Ian left, bereft of his glass half empty. Jim sitting there topping it up from the carafe. See you later on. Sports Social Podcast Network.